Welcome to Flavors Under the Big Sky, celebrating the bounty of the region. I'm Stella Fong. 2019 was a delicious year, so in this show, I wanted to honor those who made my life more flavorful through the sharing of their stories and passions. I wanted to highlight those women who have made a mark in our foodscape. Insects came to my table inspired from longtime bug advocate Florence Dunkel at Montana State University Bozeman. Beekeeper Kim Mueller showed me how honey is the flavor of sunshine, while Sunshine Field, the aquaponics operation of Veronica Everson and Ronna Klammert of Swanky Roots. I then salute pioneers Robin Bouquet of Bouquet Confections, who has made the world sweeter through her caramels, and Lane Giguiere of Matchbook Wine Company, who founded R.H. Phillips Winery with her husband, creating one of the largest wine companies near Sacramento, California. I will never forget Claudia Cravat, the ambassador of lentils, whose enthusiasm and energy has been able to showcase the bounty created by Timeless Food. Finally, I look to executive chef Lisa Rimbold of 10 at the Northern Hotel, who will endeavor to bring flavors from the past to the present and into our future. We begin with heading to Bozeman to Montana State University to hear from Dr. Florence Dunkel, Associate Professor of the Plant Sciences and Plant Pathology College of Agriculture. I helped judge the second annual Bug Cook-Off with Chef Joseph Yoon and Lynn Donaldson, where I learned a new appreciation of eating bugs. How did feasting on insects begin for Dunkel?
When I was a postdoc in Minnesota, I taught after school a pond study, it was called. And we ate everything that occurred around the pond. And so I would buy cans of grasshoppers. And they were okay, but not that exciting. But the time I really got into eating grasshoppers, or locusts they were, was when I worked in Rwanda, in East Africa. And it was a locust plague. And so the kids were selling bags of live locusts, and because they were good to eat. And so I took them back. I was staying at the Meridian, and I took them back to the chef, and he presented me with this plate of beautiful red locusts, and they were delicious. They tasted like soft-shelled crabs, and I was hooked at that point. So that was in the middle 80s, and when I took the department headship here in entomology, I decided that I would teach this course in insects, the issues of insects in human societies, and I would try serving insects. And that was the first bug buffet. We only had a pound of butter and a big, big bag of live grasshoppers, which we froze and then used and fried in the classroom. And they were all Montana grasshoppers. They were raised at the USDA Agricultural Research Service Grasshopper Lab.
For Dunkel, the consuming of insects has even greater significance.
The other thing to remember is that it's not just about good nutrition, it's about environmental sustainability. This is a huge, huge issue. And not only are insects delicious, but if we don't begin to include them in our diet or bring them back into our diet because they are a paleo food, then we won't really be able to survive very well. We have to reduce our carbon footprint, but we have to reduce our footprint of agriculture right now. And we can do that by beginning to include insects in our diet and in the feed for our domestic animals, too. And to give you an example with some numbers, if we raised a pound of beef, edible beef, we would be using 2,600 gallons of water. And this includes, of course, the water used to grow the food. If we'd be raising a pound of edible insects, we would require 1 gallon. That's a difference of 2,600.
For those of us who might be bugged about eating insects, here's news for you.
First of all, we all eat insects, even if we're vegetarian, and we have enjoyed insects. How many of you have eaten Fig Newtons? Fig Newtons, by definition, are full of fig wasps because the fig is an inside-out flower, and it traps the fig wasps after they've pollinated the flowers that are inside the fig. And so you never know they're there. They're not the crunchy thing that you crunch. Those are seeds when you eat a fig. So that's one insect that we eat all the time. We also eat insects in frozen spinach, in tomato paste, in ketchup, in almost all of our foods because they're there.
Because, like, for instance, aphids may be in our spinach that we don't know about.
We can't see them. They're so small. It's like the fig wasps. They're transparent.
In 2020, Dr. Dunkel will be celebrating the 32nd Bug Buffet and 3rd Annual Bug Cook-Off, where buggy dishes will be served up. Everyone is invited, and it's a great opportunity to learn about eating insects. We continue on the pesty topic as we go to Warden, Montana to visit with beekeeper Kim Mueller. We talked with her last summer, where she gave us a primer on raising bees.
Basically, in the group of bees, there's roles. The queen bee lays the eggs. The worker bees takes care of the queen. The worker bees, are they all males? Are they all females?
The worker bees are all females, always. And there are occasional males called drones. And the queen decides in her egg-laying process if she's going to lay an egg that is fertilized. She'll either lay a worker egg or a drone egg. And when the drone hatches, all he does is wander about the hive, eat honey, eat pollen, and on nice days, he'll fly away and see if there's any queens out there that he can mate with.
It sounds like a very hard job.
Yes, and that's why there are very few compared to the worker bees. Like this time of year, I'm estimating that my hive in the end of summer has 60,000 worker bees, one queen, and I suppose several hundred drone. Now, when fall comes, the worker bees know that the drones are just there taking up space, eating up the pantry, and they will actually kick out the drones. So there will be no drones to feed over the winter.
So over the winter, and we have very harsh winters here, what happens to the hive?
There's four things that a hive needs. It needs to have a young queen, which is less than 3 years old. They need to have an adequate food supply of honey and pollen. They need to be protected from the wind. So I do vinyl wrap on my hive, black vinyl, that supposedly will help attract the sun.
The sun holds the magic for life. In the summer, it is the growth of plants, the blossoming of flowers.
I didn't ask you this, but as far as carrying the pollen, how do bees carry pollen?
If you're sitting at the hive and watching, you can see that they actually have pollen pockets on their back legs. They land on a flower and they gather that pollen with their front legs, pass it to their middle legs, and then the middle legs go ahead and put it in the pollen pockets on their rear legs. And if you're watching, you can see them come flying home with yellow, orange, green, sometimes even lilac colored pollen. And then I've read and I've heard that when the bee lands there with their pockets full of pollen, some workers will come out and help empty those pollen pockets so that same bee can head out to that same flower.
When you do harvest your honey, approximately how much do you get?
You know, the first year that I had my single colony and everything was new and I wanted to make sure that they had enough honey for themselves for the winter, because she was my only queen, she was my only colony, I was able to harvest 14 cups of honey. I was thrilled with it, and every precious drop was just like liquid sunshine. I loved it. 14 cups.
The sun not only brings to life pollen for bees to create honey, but shines light into the aquaponics operation at Swanky Roots. Owners Veronica Everson and Rana Klamert use a gravity-fed water system where poop from bluegill nourish the raising of lettuce and other greens. We traveled to just outside Billings towards Laurel to first talk to Veronica Everson.
This is not your traditional farming found here in Montana. So maybe we'll start with the name Swanky. Where did that come from?
So Swanky is actually my mother's maiden name. And as we were kind of looking into options, she brought that to me and it just kind of stuck. And I feel like it's a really good fit for what we're doing here. I mean, a lot of times when people think of Swanky, you think of kind of fun, fancier, newer type things. And that's kind of what we're about.
So you grow lettuce and kale, and I even saw nasturtium flowers there with a bunch of herbs. Was it around the dinner table one night that you sat around and said, hey, Mom, I want to open up this greenhouse business?
Actually, she came to me with this idea. I was nearing graduation at Montana State University in Bozeman, looking into job options. I was just finishing up my student teaching and trying to figure out where it is I wanted to go. And she showed me this aquaponic system from a company called Nelson and Paid. And at first I was like, yeah, whatever. It's just one of your side projects. I don't know. And then the more I looked into it, the more I really fell in love with it. It's very scientific based, which is what I'm very passionate about. And it made sense to me, the combination between the fish and the plants and not having to add a bunch of different chemicals and things like that. It just seemed like a really great way to grow.
The idea for the great way to grow came from Mother Rana Glamert.
Well, I had a little greenhouse at my house and I had some tomato plants that Veronica brought home from Bozeman when she was in college. And I said, what kind are these? And she's like, I don't know. They got mixed up with the tags. I'm like, we'll plant them anyways. Well, they were cherry tomatoes. And in the greenhouse, they just bloomed and bloomed and just tons of tomatoes. Well, then they got so many, they started splitting and they got some white flies on them. And I had some strawberries in there and had a slug problem. And Veronica didn't like slugs and she wouldn't touch the strawberries, even if it didn't look like there was one crawled on it. So I was online looking for what I could do naturally to fix these problems. And this little Nelson and Paid thing came up on the side. And so it interested me and I started looking and I'm like, no slugs, no white flies. I like this. And so the more I looked into it, I thought, you know, this would be the way to go. You got all your natural vitamins coming and all your no pesticides, herbicides, and you don't have to worry about all them. And so just kept checking into it and this is what happened.
Thanks to Swanky Roots founders Clamart and Everson for bringing spring year-round to Montana, growing fresh greens for our table. Come back to the second part of Flavors Under the Big Sky, where we talk to other pioneers, Robin Bacay, Lane Guillier, and Claudia Cravat. Welcome back to the second part of Flavors Under the Big Sky. In this show, I am showcasing the women I interviewed this last year that inspired me with their passion with making or creating food for our table. Perhaps my biggest heroine may have been Robin Bacay, founder of Bacay Confections in Bozeman. My show with Bacay was a lesson in creating a successful business with hard work and tenacity. So did you have a business plan? Did you start selling at farmers markets? How did it all start? Was it started online? And it's a little bit of giving a lesson to someone who may want to pursue this. How did you start?
It was definitely bootstrapped. While I was at Gore, 15 years at Gore, Gore, even though it's a very large corporation, likes to have small independent businesses. And they had a business model that encouraged all of us to test our market assumptions as inexpensively as possible, which is bootstrapping. So we actually launched this business for under $1,000 with a licensed kitchen. Yeah, really remarkable. But I'm a fiscal conservative, and I like to be very cautious with the money that I've worked hard to earn and save. And so we did a test market here in Bozeman, Big Sky, Livingston. I think that was pretty much our first test market. I was very pleasantly surprised at how things went, especially with the reception from all the businesses that I approached. I was warmed beyond words as to how everybody in Montana was willing to try. Each time I'd present the product to someone, they'd say, let's give it a try. Montanans take making a living very seriously. We don't take it for granted. And someone else mentioned to me in the early days, it's very Montanan to start a business. And I love that about this place. Your neighbors, the businesses that surround us, everybody wants to help each other out and help each other succeed. And I've said many times in the course of our business, I don't know that this business would have succeeded anywhere besides Bozeman because of the warm support from all the businesses as well as consumers. I'm grateful.
I want to ask you a little bit about the details in your very beginning before you became mechanized. Did you
wrap all the caramels? What did you do to get yourself started?
In our initial test market phase, we wanted to keep our capital investments to a minimum. So we did everything by hand. Caramel was made in a little $25 pot, a deep fryer that I bought at Walmart, because you could set the thermostat to a particular setting and I could have a consistent process. It made 5 pounds of caramel. Then we would cut it by hand. I needed a guide, and I found a wire rack at probably Walmart again. It's just a little shelf. Turned it upside down and could press the bars. The little wires are 3/4 of an inch apart, and pressed it into our caramel. That's what determined what the width of the caramel was that initial inexpensive tool to help us cut straight. Then we cut them by hand, and we wrapped them by hand. We weighed every piece to make sure that it hit a range so that if a person's buying a piece, buying the caramel by the piece, which most people do, we're ensuring they got a consistent piece size. I wrapped more than 10,000 pieces by hand, probably tens of thousands, before we got our first caramel wrapper. It was a $30,000 piece of equipment. Moving from our test market into our first facility, we spent about $60,000 on equipment. Maybe it was less than that. Maybe it was more like $45,000. We took out a second mortgage on our home to be able to do this. And I desperately hoped I wasn't going to be the proud owner of a $30,000 caramel wrapper with no business. Very scary time. Now I buy a $100,000 piece of equipment, you know, because it's a good investment. That's that. And there's no looking back. But that $30,000 wrapper was the scariest, one of the scariest chapters. Of course, it all worked out, but it was a scary time.
So when you said taste test, did you bring out one sample? I mean, now you have 13 varieties. You must have just started with one basic type, or did you have a variety where you would present to your customers or taste testers, and did you ask them what they thought?
That's a great question. So we started with a classic vanilla caramel. I like my confections a little chewy, with some resistance to the bite. And so we had early test batches I would take to my daughter's figure skating club. So the moms there would give me their feedback. And one batch came out very soft, and I was very disappointed. So I was apologizing as I'm handing it out to everyone. Oh, this one's really soft. And one of the moms set me straight. The softer, the better. I'm like, really? So surprised to hear that, because we all assume that our tastes are what everybody else appreciates as well. So then we did taste tests on texture. Who preferred soft? Who preferred a little bit chewier or a little bit firmer? Our taste test showed 55% of those tested prefer it soft, 45% prefer it chewy. So we decided we better launch both. So we started with that with no anticipation we would have other varieties, or I would have named them something other than soft and chewy.
The caramels of Bouquet Confections have obviously been softly and deliciously chewed by many. The small company in its very beginning made a strong impact on the candy world.
When you go to something, and I've been to the Fancy Food Show, and I know that you've had a booth there, how do you, amongst the 5 football fields of booths and tables of people with food, how do you showcase and shine your product?
Samples. We have samples on the table in abundance because tasting our caramel is a surprise to a lot of people. My favorite memory of all of our trade shows is the untold number of times a buyer comes up, smiles politely, picks up a sample, takes 2 steps away, pops it in their mouth, reverses those steps, comes back and says, "Oh, my word." Nothing's more warming than that to me. And in the early days, our first show, that was very common because there were no great caramels at that time at the show. Now there are a lot of small caramel businesses that attend the show that make really some pretty decent caramel. But at the time, there was nothing like what we were doing. That made all the difference for us.
When was your first show? Do you remember?
I'm going to get close by guessing 2006, 2004. We fortunately did win an award. There's an aisle by aisle award each year at the show. They don't do it anymore, but the Gourmet Retailer, a magazine that covers the industry, sent 17 judges onto the floor, and they each get 1/17th of those 5 football fields of exhibits. I think it's almost 3,000 booths at the show. So this person is going to taste and see a lot of things. And the person whose area included our booth chose us as the best product for that 17th of the floor. It was warming beyond words because it was, to say intimidating is an understatement, going to our first show, looking at these elaborate booths people have. Right across from us was someone with a horse-drawn peanut roaster. It was gorgeous. It was an antique. It was a thing of beauty. And here I am with my tablecloth and tables, 2 varieties, soft and chewy, packaged in 2 different ways, and repeating the display all over the booth so it looked full.
The sweet lesson I took away from Robin Bouquet for a successful pursuit is to have a plan and to stick to it. The next woman we talked to is Lane Guiguerre of Matchbook Wine Company. With her husband, John, she founded R.H. Phillips Winery just outside of Sacramento, California in 1984 to become one of the largest wineries in the area. The business was bought by a big corporation in 2002. The Guilliers were the wine masters for this year's MSU Billings Wine and Food Festival, representing their new enterprise, Matchbook Wine Company. Lane Guilliere provided some sage advice for enjoying wine. Sometimes I think wine drinkers are a bit insecure in their choices. You know, I often hear, I don't drink that much wine. I don't know that much about it. I like Cabernet. What advice would you give our listeners as to how they can continue to enjoy and grow their wine drinking experience?
I think that's such a good question, because I think that's something, a perception that we've been battling since the very beginning. There shouldn't be any stigma of what you like or don't like. I think if you like something, enjoy it. And if you have a glass of something and you really don't like it, don't drink it. Move on. And I think that's why all of us are making so many different types of wines, so many styles of wines, because people like so many different things. Just drink what you like is my advice.
I like that advice.
So what does Guilliere have to say about savoring wine with food?
Started R.H. Phillips in 1981, there really wasn't a wine and food culture at all. And so all of us in California, we were all working to, it was sort of a pioneering effort to bring wine to the table and make it part of a meal. And it's so interesting to be a part of that at the beginning, and now that it's really become part of the culture, part of the table, farm to fork food with wine and the pairing. And it's been exciting to see all that come together and become part of everyday life.
From the cheer of Lane Guilliere of Matchbook Wine Company, we go to the cheer of Claudia Cravat in Bozeman, who owns Claudia's Mesa, with mesa meaning table in Spanish. With her energy and enthusiasm, she has not only been an ambassador to her food from her childhood in Colombia, but also an advocate for locally grown legumes such as lentils. She works with Timeless Foods to showcase the lentils, chickpeas, and barley grown on Montana soil as a way to naturally replace nitrogen in the ground. On a summer evening, Ken Sieber and I went to Dinosaur Park in Bozeman, where we met up with Cravat as she was hosting one of her pop-up dinners.
And at the beginning, I was popping up in really out of the ordinary places, like sites, because I was in construction. Just a weird job site, and decorated very eclectic, at art galleries, at artist studios, because I love combining food, music, the arts, literature, and movies, etc. And then I got tired of schlepping a lot, because you go to a farm, I do them at farms as well, you have to take the stove with you, you have to take the propane tank with you, and I started doing them in my backyard. I mean, 2 acres, if I invite my neighbors, they won't complain, right?
Right.
And that's how I do them. I have a small studio in town, and it's a great place for lunch and learns.
Claudia then found Timeless Seeds, Timeless Food.
I met David actually through Facebook. Very interesting. I found him because I was born and raised in South America, in Colombia and the Caribbean coast, and I lived 25 years in Miami. And since my childhood, I have always been supporting the local growers. It wasn't uncommon for my mother to go to the open market to buy freshly grown vegetables. We would get fish from a peddler somewhere in the area. And when I moved to Miami as a college student, I wanted to do the same. So I found the East Coast fisheries in the Miami River, and I found the homestead market where a lot of the delicious oranges come from. And I always tell everybody that I married a Marco Polo of sorts, my husband Steve, and he brought me to Bozeman, to Montana, and this is in 1985. We came to ski Big Sky, and we just fell in love with it. Everybody thought that these snowbirds, these tropical birds, were gonna leave the area, but we are here for, we'll be celebrating our 21st year. So I wanted to see how I could bring the same way of cooking and eating as I had as a child, and I was fortunate to meet Tiffany Latch of Sola, who was fostering meetings for the winter farmers market. So I met a lot of farmers there that were just starting out. This was about 10 years ago. And I learned that there was more to Montana than frigid weather and that there were local growers. And I started buying cheeses from Amalthea and vegetables from Gallatin Botanical. And when I went to Town and Country one day, I looked up and there were these beautiful lentils of different colors.
Cravat's discovery of these colorful lentils changed her way of eating and cooking in Bozeman.
So when I found out that I could actually eat something from my childhood, from my Colombia, and support a local grower, I was ecstatic. I was so happy. So I searched who this timeless food was, and I found him via Facebook. We started exchanging, and he could not believe that I made different things besides lentil soup and lentil salad. And one day, he came over to Bozeman with somebody that uses his processing plant to bring rice from the Philippines, this beautiful heirloom rice. And Dave and I had coffee, and he all of a sudden said, I have a conference call with Liz Carlisle, whose book is all about us. And I'm like, really? I just met the guy, so now there's a book about him. So I was like very impressed. So he said, they're writing a book about us, and it's called The Lentil Underground. So I know what the underground was in my time. And I was saying, well, what is this? What is this Lentil Underground? So I found out that these were a group of farmers, Montana farmers, four different, very different characters who defied agribusiness. And I studied sociology in school, and I was a rebel, and I wanted to be the Colombian Angela Davis. So this was like, I could do this with food.
From the Bozeman Angela Davis, we go to the Northern Hotel in Billings, where we talk briefly with executive chef Lisa Rimble, who heads up the culinary operation at the hotel. Her responsibilities include catering for special events at the hotel, as well as executing meals at 10, the fine dining restaurant. Rimble shares how she got into the business and basically summarizes why so many fall in love with sharing food.
I guess what drew me to being a chef was that my grandfather was a chef. My sister owned a restaurant. I was raised in that industry, and I love the feeling of the industry itself. I like being in a kitchen. I like being part of that culture. And it's a really nice feeling that you're able to give something to somebody's special day. You're a part of that, and hopefully they go away remembering what you served for them.
Well, there is no better gift than having food and a full tummy at the end of a great holiday meal.
Right, and if they come to 10, they don't have to cook it themselves.
That's even better.
Yeah, so it's really fun to do. It's very crazy on holidays, but we do a really nice job of still having a fine dining menu for the holiday.
I love it. I hope that tradition continues and moves forward.
Thank you.
Executive Chef Lisa Rimbold and all the women from this show, as well as the people I had the honor to interview this last year, shared one thing: passion. The love for what they do and create is passed on to us in the dish we eat and the spirit we sip. Thank you for making our life more flavorful. Happy New Year to you and yours. May 2020 bring you delicious flavors from Bounty from under the big sky. Many thanks to Parker Brown for providing the theme music. Thanks to Ken Siebert for his production assistance. Additional funding has been provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communications on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanians. Thanks to you, listeners, for your support. I'm Stella Fong.